Welcome to Applied, I'm Baron Gogan. Today I'm joined by Darren Davidson, the Sustainable Landscape Specialist with CSU Extension. Darren has many years of experience working in the field of horticulture, with a focus on native plants, water conservation, pollinator habitat, and sustainable landscape design. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So how do we define sustainability at CSU?
It's a good question. So there are different definitions of sustainability, and it kind of depends on what context you're looking at, but certainly at CSU on campus and when you're talking about the context of sustainable landscapes, we want to make sure that our practices, whatever we're doing, is meeting the needs of the current generation while not compromising the needs of future generations. And so sustainability is a dynamic balance of three factors. It's social, economic, and environmental. And so we take those three factors and we want to think about the impact that whatever our practices are, we want to think about the impact that we're having in all three of those realms. And where those overlap, we then are being able to have a more sustainable impact and more sustainable outcomes in whatever we're doing.
If someone wanted to focus on one of those three first, what would you say is the most important?
So it depends. You know, you don't really want to pull one out away from the other two, right? Because we're trying to find that overlap. But one of the easiest, sort of clearest examples that I often point to, which is actually an unsustainable practice, but is logging. Mm-hmm. So clear-cutting forest, using that material for building and heating and whatever it might be. So economically speaking, it's great. It's creating jobs. People are making money. Socially, again, there's community around that. You have a good workforce. But environmentally speaking, it's terrible. So you perhaps have the social and the economic realms covered, but you don't have the environmental piece. So that is not a sustainable practice. Mm. And so when we're looking at, you know, how are we meeting the needs of current generations without compromising for future generations, we want to be thinking about like our extractive industries, or if we're looking at sustainable landscapes, how are we treating the soils? How are we growing the plants? Maybe it's we're getting a good product right now, but we want to make sure that we're not having a lasting impact that it is going to make it more difficult for future generations to have healthy soil, be able to grow their crops, whether it's food or landscape plants, and so on.
So planting a lot of non-native plants could be an example of a problematic approach to sustainability.
It could, yeah. And I definitely like to be careful with, you know, comparing native plants versus not native plants. Native plants are always, I think, going to provide more benefit than a non-native plant because they tend to use less water. They're going to support more biodiversity because they're going to be nectar and pollen sources for pollinators, things like that. But we also want to look at what it takes to grow those plants. And so if our plant production is, you know, relying heavily on inputs like extractive inputs, we're having to put lots of fertilizer or pesticides or those sorts of things, that type of industry is not necessarily going to be doing very sustainable practices because we're having to put all of these inputs in to grow the plants and make them look healthy. And hopefully that plant will then survive in the landscape, but maybe not. And so we've spent all this money, we've used all these resources, and the plant isn't even really doing that much in the landscape. So definitely plant choice plays a big part in sustainable landscapes, and native plants tend to be more on the side of sustainability or sustainable practices. But I do like to be careful because it's not a one-size-fits-all. Just only natives isn't necessarily the only way to go.
So in terms of maintaining soil health, mm-hmm. is the jury still out on amending?
So again, it depends on what you're growing. So one thing that happens is we get people who are excited about doing their landscaping and they sort of bring the mentality of vegetable gardening to it. And they're like, well, first thing I need to do is put a lot of compost in there, get the soil really rich and happy for plants. Mm. But a more sustainable approach is going to be, I'm going to do a soil test, figure out what's going on in my soil before I start to change anything, because you need to have that baseline. Mm-hmm. And then you want to match your plants to your soil. So we have right plant, right place. And a lot of people kind of flip that and they think, well, I'm going to amend my soil. I'm going to try to change the soil and then it'll be ready to receive plants, but it is really hard to actually have significant impact in changing soils. I mean, they are, you know, soils happen over thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And then if we think, well, we're just going to dump some compost and it's going to change it significantly, you know,
that doesn't really work that way.
It doesn't really work that way. So, but if you're doing like vegetable gardening or agriculture, yeah, you do want to get lots of organic matter going in there. But if you're doing landscaping plants and you're doing xeric plants, native plants, they don't want that. They don't want that rich of a soil. They don't want that much organic matter. So that's kind of an added step that people don't necessarily need to take. But again, it all starts with a soil test. So you don't want to change something before you know what's already going on. Sustainability is definitely a buzzword. And like I said, lots of different sectors and groups and organizations use the term sustainability. But if you really get down to sort of the core of what it is, it's the triple bottom line. It's taking those three factors into consideration. And yeah, finding that balance.
So I imagine when some organizations talk about sustainability, they're only talking about one or maybe two of those and not all three.
I think that's probably true. Again, it's a buzzword.
Yeah.
And so if somebody is really trying to, you know, work with an organization or find a vendor who claims sustainability, I think doing a little research and due diligence to really see what they mean and how they're defining sustainability is key. Because anybody can say we're sustainable, but unless they're really, really doing the work, then they're not necessarily.
Right. What does the due diligence look like there?
I just mean really looking into their practices. You know, if they slap that word up on a website and say we're sustainable, you know, and if you're really dedicated to finding someone or something that is sustainable, you know, look at their track record, see how they define sustainability. You know, why are they calling themselves sustainable?
What are some of those important things to consider when trying to make landscaping specifically more sustainable?
So I think that, you know, a lot of people, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, are really getting on board with things like water conservation, xeriscapes, really paying attention to pollinators and wanting to provide habitat. So those are pieces of a sustainable landscape. But if we're looking, again, at balancing those three factors, you have to take more into consideration than just like xeriscaping, pollinator habitat for sustainable landscapes. So we're looking at plant selection, where our plants are coming from, how they're grown, definitely the amount of water we're putting down, where our materials are coming from for like hardscape, timber, rocks, pavers, that sort of thing. Sort of an easy example there is thinking through things like, if somebody's totally redoing their landscape, you know, they might be pulling up a sidewalk. Well, what are you going to do with that sidewalk material? Are you just chucking it, taking it to the dump? That's not a sustainable practice. You're going to want to try to reuse it somewhere else in your landscape or pass it on to somebody else who can reuse it. So it's really thinking through kind of the minutiae, but every step of the process, where material is coming from, where, how you're using it. So it's much bigger than just, you know, the plants and the habitat kind of thing. I keep pointing to plants and water and habitat because those are things that people are really starting to understand, which is great. And often that's what, it's sort of the gateway to getting into this sort of thing, but there is more to it.
Right. The plants, the water, those are the most obvious choices to make. There's more layers.
There's more layers. It's, yeah, a lot of layers, kind of that onion analogy. And you can just dig deeper and deeper. And, you know, we all have to start somewhere. We might have a tiny yard. We might have a huge landscape. And I think starting with bite-sized pieces is really key until you kind of get into the groove of it. But yeah, there are a lot of different things to think through. Another one, you know, I said the social aspect is key for sustainability. So human health and well-being. If it's your garden, your landscape that you're tending, that's good for you. You're getting outside, you're moving your body, you're getting sunlight, fresh air. So there's that social or human component. If it's a commercial landscape, thinking about the users of the space, not just, you know, what is it going to look like? How much is it going to cost? But actually, how are users going to interact with the space? And again, thinking through all of that.
So in your view, if someone is just getting started with this, what's probably the most important thing to do first?
I think that having an understanding of your site. So if we just go to sort of basic landscape design principles, you know, you need to know what you have in your site. You need to do a site analysis. do a soil test, understand your soil. That's going to help you determine what plants are going to work in your site. And then the plants are going to determine what kind of habitat you're able to create and so on and so on. But I think, you know, even before you're really trying to put on the lens of sustainability, just really understanding your space and your site and knowing what you have to work with is the first step before you can make any changes. And then as you're going through the process, you can sort of put that sustainability lens on each of your decisions or your decision-making process. Mm-hmm. So when you get to the point of, okay, I'm going to pick my mulch. What kind of mulch am I using? Where am I sourcing it from? Or it's time to pick my plant palette. Where am I getting those plants? Where were those grown? How far did they have to get trucked to get to the store that I'm going to go get them from? So on and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now, is mulch considered a sustainable choice? I've heard mixed things on that.
Oh, interesting. Yes. Mulch is definitely, well, it's an important part of landscaping, and I think it, if done correctly, then it is going to be sustainable. So mulch is, it's going to help for lots of different things. It's going to help for with weed suppression. It doesn't totally eradicate weeds, but it helps with weed suppression. It can help hold moisture in the soil, things like that. If you choose the wrong mulch, it might not be a sustainable choice. So
what's an example of the wrong mulch?
So if you're doing, say you're transitioning your landscape to a xeriscape, so really dry, it's still going to need some water, but you're choosing plants that match your soil and they hardly need any water. And you've heard CSU Extension say mulch is really important. So you get your mulch. And if you use a really like a shredded bark or a wood chip mulch around those xeric plants and you think you're doing the right thing, we call those organic mulches because they're made out of organic material versus an inorganic mulch, which would be like a rock mulch. So if you use that wood material, that's going to hold a lot of moisture. And if we're doing xeric plants, they don't want a lot of moisture right around the base of the plant. And so you're probably going to kill your plant with that mulch selection. So then you're going to have to source new plants and plant new plants. Not a sustainable choice. So it's things like that. So you can also look at with mulch, you know, where it's sourced. Is it local? Did it come from, you know, like cedar mulch from the Pacific Northwest? A lot of people say we should not be using that kind of mulch because of how far it has to be trucked when we have things that could be sourced more locally. So a couple different factors when thinking about mulch.
What are your thoughts on recycled rubber mulch?
Not a fan. It has a place, like a lot of playgrounds use that as sort of a soft playing or a soft landing material. But even with that, I have some questions. I mean, it's rubber, it's a petroleum product. It's still going to get ground up and broken into tiny little pieces. That's going to probably inevitably make it into the turf grass that's right next to it or to, you know.
Not biodegradable.
It's going to make it into the soil. So then we're changing the whole system with that. So not a fan. I do appreciate that it's another use for that material. Right? It's not going in the landfill, but I don't think it's a great option for landscapes.
Conserving water is obviously a big part of sustainable landscaping, especially in arid and semi-arid regions like Colorado. What are a few of the best ways to reduce water usage and still have a beautiful landscape property?
Well, so you're absolutely right. You know, water is one of our, if not our most precious resource here in the arid West. And again, through healthy soil, so if we started our soil, if we know that we have good, healthy soil that can really infiltrate water, it's not compacted, it's not shedding water, that's going to allow any water that we do put on, whether it's natural precipitation or from our irrigation system, that's going to ensure that that water gets into the ground where we need it. So mm-hmm. That's one thing. And then plant selection. So there's a misconception that a xeriscape means zero scape, like just rocks, no plants. And that is one of the biggest things we're trying to educate on is that misconception. It does not mean zero scape. Some people actually say zero when it's actually xeric, meaning dry. So a xeriscape still has plants. It's still planted pretty heavily. We don't have big expanses of rock, but those plants just don't need as much water. And something that happens is people think, okay, I'm putting in a xeriscape, it's going to be rock mulch, which is fine. but then they put their plants really sparsely. It's a really sparsely planted landscape. And then that rock mulch absorbs a lot of heat and then radiates the heat back out. And then you contribute to the heat island effect. So we don't want tons and tons of rock exposed. We want to have a nice full planted bed.
For shade, essentially?
Basically, yeah, to shade the rock mulch, exactly. Mm. And to so you can create different microclimates with plants. So if you think about starting at ground covers and then moving up to annuals and perennials, ornamental grasses, shrubs, and trees, so sort of going up the stair step that way, each of those plants is going to create a microclimate for the next plant. So it's going to shade the roots. It's going to create some vertical structure, which is really important if you're trying to attract pollinators and support invertebrates and insects. So again, there are so many, you know, we're working with these dynamic living systems. So there are so many things that you can think about. So that vertical structure for invertebrates, that doesn't necessarily have a whole lot to do with low water use, but it's one of those things where once you start thinking through your landscape, you can just see all of these other benefits unfold. So you've got good soil, you're choosing the right plants that don't use a lot of water, you have a good percentage of plant cover, that plant palette and that plant structure is then providing habitat for pollinators, and it just keeps building on itself.
So you have to think about it as a layered approach with multiple tiers and layers that all kind of work together to support the whole system, as opposed to I'm just going to put a bunch of rocks out and put a couple of plants here and there.
Exactly. And yeah, I think you just summed up what you said really sort of encapsulates sustainable landscapes, is that we're looking at it holistically. So we're looking at all of the different moving parts and pieces. And arguably, that makes it more complicated than just what you said, you know, just some rocks and a couple plants. But it also makes it more interesting and it makes it more impactful. And that is one of the really cool things, is that even if you have a small yard, you can have an impact. You know, you can really contribute to biodiversity and water conservation and all these different things.
So obviously dealing with weeds can be a big struggle. I know it is in my own yard. Are there weed control methods that are both effective and sustainable?
Yes, the struggle is real. Weeds will always be there. Again, we're working with these living systems, especially if we are applying supplemental water, you know, and there if there's an open space of soil, probably a weed seed there and it's going to grow. So I would say there are different weed management strategies. Ideally, if you just have a really healthy, thriving landscape, there's going to be less room for weeds to move in, so you're going to have fewer weeds. You know, we all have to kind of work at this and continually tweak what we have. So I would say weed management, you know, when we're talking about pests and weeds, we talk a lot about IPM, integrated pest management. And that's a concept where we have a toolbox and there's a spectrum of things that can be done, everything from mechanical. So if we're talking about weeds, that's hand pulling, you know, putting in the elbow grease and the sweat equity there, all the way through the spectrum to like using herbicides. When used properly, herbicides can be a safe and effective tool. Some people want to stay away from herbicides altogether, so it's just a balancing act. They have to educate themselves, they have to decide which one is going to work for them, and then that's probably going to be the most sustainable approach.
In my yard here in Fort Collins, Colorado, I struggle with a weed that a lot of people struggle with, bindweed, which grows incredibly fast. Pulling does basically nothing but make it have to grow back, which it does very quickly. For very persistent, fast-growing weeds and sometimes invasive weeds where pulling isn't working, is that a time when you would maybe go to chemical treatment?
Yeah, so bindweed, Canada thistle, things like that, so hard to control. And one thing that's really important to understand is what we see above ground, the vegetative growth, is typically a fraction of what's going on below ground in the soil. The root systems are vast. They're huge. They're strong. So, like you said, if you're pulling or mowing or cutting them back, you know, you're just scratching the surface. So some people have been successful with continually pulling or mowing, and by continually, I mean years. And every time you do that, you're starving the plant of its ability to photosynthesize and create energy, and so you're weakening the root system. However, if you don't have the time to do that, or you've just done it long enough and you want a different solution, then yeah, an appropriate chemical applied is going to be probably much more successful. And, you know, there's the hope that you'll only need to apply it once, maybe twice, and then you'll be done with it and you can move on. So it's not like you're having to repeat over and over and over.
As far as controlling weeds with the landscaping itself, you had mentioned mulch, and you need to put something under that mulch, I assume, some sort of weed barrier. What are your recommendations there? Because I've heard mixed opinions on weed barriers from the stuff that you get at the hardware store that water can penetrate through, sort of like a fabric. Some people use newspaper or cardboard, all kinds of different things, right?
Yeah, so with a name like weed barrier or weed fabric, you would think it would do a great job of keeping weeds out, but it really doesn't. So we no longer recommend weed fabric or weed barrier. For a long time, it was the industry standard, but like a lot of things, we learned. And it really, for most situations, not all, it's more of a pain than it's worth. Over time, you know, we get big winds here in Colorado, dirt blows around and it'll settle. Even if you have your layer of weed fabric and then a layer of mulch, dirt is going to settle there and weeds will grow on top of that.
Yes, I've seen that firsthand.
There you go. So, A, it's not keeping weeds out. Some of the really strong weeds like the Canada thistle and the bindweed, they will just grow until they find sunlight and they will peek out from the edges.
Tiniest crack or
exactly,
hole.
Exactly. The tiniest crack, the tiniest hole. If there's a little bit of extra water coming in at the edge, they're going to pop up out from under the weed fabric. The other thing is that it's always pulling up on the edges and you have to continually apply more mulch and you have to dig it in. And and then it starts to degrade too after a handful of years. And it can kind of, you know, depending on what kind you have, it can get brittle and sort of break apart. And then those bits and pieces are getting incorporated into the soil. So weed fabric is out. There are some situations where if you absolutely know that you have a strip or you have an area where it's not going to be vegetated for any reason, you're just going to keep kind of larger rock on it, maybe, you know, that might be a spot for it. But for general landscaping practices, you want to avoid weed fabric.
And so just nothing, but
just
mulch.
Nothing. You just put the mulch right on the soil.
Okay. No yep. Newspaper, cardboard.
So you can do that. I wouldn't say that it's necessary. One thing that happens sometimes is because we're so arid, if you put newspaper or cardboard down and then mulch on top of that, it's so dry that it just sits there. The idea with that kind of mulching is that it's going to break down over time. But just like often with our compost piles here in Colorado, we have to actually water our compost piles because it's not wet enough and you need that moisture for the decomposition. Other parts of the country, Pacific Northwest, back east, there's enough moisture that's coming in naturally that's going to decompose and start to build the soil and be great. But yeah, here it's not going to be a huge advantage. Now, that's not to say that people haven't had success with it. Some people, you know, they swear by it. They say, I had great success. It was really good. And that's fine. And so if people want to experiment with it, then by all means, but it's not necessary. A good thick layer of the right kind of mulch, whatever it is for your situation, is going to be just fine right on top of the soil.
Okay.
And I cannot give you the specific study, but I did recently read that some of our cardboard has some pretty toxic materials in it. And so there again, we're letting that break down and go into the soils. And so
that's
maybe
not
the best choice. Yeah.
Getting back to water real quick, you mentioned that soil health is important, looking at the soil in your yard or on your property and determining what that needs to look like in order to be able to take the water. So things like aerating, amending come into play. Could you talk a little bit more about that and what that looks like?
Sure. So it depends on what your landscaping goals are for that area. If we're talking about turf, you definitely want to aerate. If you can do it in the spring and the fall, that's great. you know, recommendations are that your lawn looks like Swiss cheese afterwards. Like you want, if you're doing it yourself or you're hiring a company, you want them to take several passes. A lot of companies will do two passes, one in one direction and then one in the opposite. But if they can go on the diagonal also, that's really good. Mm. So that's going to break things up and really be beneficial. And that's going to help keep your turf healthy.
So a lot of people are maybe under aerating.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are. Yeah. A lot of people just don't do it. A lot of people either do it once a year but don't have the company do enough passes. So yeah, you want to Swiss cheese your turf. But then if you're talking about landscape beds where you might have perennials and shrubs and that sort of thing, or if that's your plan for a space, you might want to amend, but you might not. So that's where a soil test comes into play. Mm. And that's going back to the beginning when I said you need to do a site assessment and know what you have.
What would you be testing for with a soil test?
So you're testing for, you're figuring out the different components of your soil. So we have sand, silt, and clay basically are the materials that make up soil. Mm-hmm. And you need to know the different ratios. Along the Front Range, we typically have pretty sticky clay soils or some pretty like lean kind of rocky soils. And so we don't necessarily, if we have a very lean soil that doesn't have a lot of organic matter in it, you can definitely add compost and you can do some amending. But what we want to try to get out of people's heads is no matter what, before I plant, I need to add a bunch of compost and amend. You know, it sounds like a really good thing to do, but you also want to really match your plants to what your soil already is, if possible. You might need to do some amending, but it's pretty hard to change soil significantly. It's taken many, many, many years for that soil to build and become what it is. And so if you have a very clayey soil, a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to bring in a bunch of organic matter and I'm going to really try to change that. But the other thing that you could do is just find plants that can handle that kind of soil. Mm-hmm. So
some plants just will never thrive in the soil, no matter how much you amend it.
Exactly. And we say, you know, we use the term right plant, right place a lot. But right plant, I think part of that is matching the plant to your soil type. That's going to be a lot easier than trying to change your soil.
Yeah. Now, soil pH is also a factor, I understand.
It is, yeah. So again, along the Front Range and much of this area, we have very alkaline soils, so a high pH. And again, there are some plants that can handle that and love it, and there are some plants that hate it. They need more acidic soils. So if you move to Colorado from somewhere else and there's a plant that you loved, again, from like the Pacific Northwest where they have more acidic soils, and you really, really want to grow it here, I think you kind of either need to let go of that or just know that you're going to have to amend the heck out of that soil to try to get it suitable for the plant. And you can do it. Like gardening is so much about trial and error and having fun and experimenting.
Yeah.
But you just have to know that it's much easier, less work, more sustainable, right? We're not having to bring in all these amendments if we can match the plant to the existing soil.
What about a raised bed situation where you're essentially creating a space for a plant? You're putting the soil in
mm-hmm.
on top of the existing soil.
So that's a totally unique situation to that raised bed. So then you have a lot more flexibility because you're bringing in a planter's mix or whatever it might be from, you know, your material yard. So I would say that's a different situation. A raised bed is essentially a big container. So then you have more flexibility.
Do you think raised beds can be sustainable or a combination, or is there kind of a preference there?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about raised beds with the sustainability lens, but I would say for some people, raised beds are going to be a great option because they're raised, they're higher, they're more accessible. You don't have to get down so low on the ground, so it might be easier to garden that way. You're going to have to put considerable amount of money into it, so you have to, you know, take that into consideration.
Yes, and there's whole irrigation type systems,
yep.
drip systems that you can install, and
right.
even water recycling that you can put mm-hmm. underneath of those. Of course, that's all a lot of work and
right.
Engineering.
Right. So I think it, again, sustainability, if we're looking at it on sort of that micro scale of your backyard, you have to determine what's sustainable for you. So there are always going to be certain things like we want to try to work with the soil we have. We want to choose the right plants. We want to have water conservation, those things. But it also is dependent on you, what you're willing to put into your garden, how much time you have to spend, how much resources you have. So there's sort of, you know, the kind of macro sustainability lens and then kind of a micro sustainability lens.
If people in Colorado have questions about sustainable landscaping, such as the types of plants that they should probably look for, how to test soil, what's involved there, what are some good resources?
So we have several different resources. I would check out the CSU Extension website. And if you go under publications, we have lots of fact sheets and bulletins and information there. And then also contact your local Extension office. So CSU Extension serves all 64 counties of Colorado. So if you get in touch with them, there's going to be somebody there who can help point you in the right direction. And then we're also going to be having some new programming coming out that is all about specifically sustainable landscaping practices, sort of the big picture of why we want to do it, and then diving into more of the how to do those practices. So people can be on the lookout for that too.
Now for folks outside of Colorado, should they contact their state extension office if they have one?
Yes, the extension Cooperative Extension Service is national, so it's a wonderful resource for anybody. Absolutely contact, you can contact the state, go straight to the university, or see if there's an extension office in your county. And then actually some of the programming that I was just referencing that we're going to be launching in the spring is going to have national reach. So it's not going to be Colorado specific. Mm. It's very much sustainable landscaping specific. And a lot of these principles apply no matter where you are. But then we have opportunities for extension offices to sort of customize those and make them more local. So lots of ways, lots of resources for people in Colorado and beyond.
Great. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Applied. If you'd like more information on landscaping, gardening, native plants, soil health, xeriscaping, and much more, CSU Extension has more than 100 different articles available on the topic of yard and garden, and you can find a link to that resource in the show notes. Take care.